It's time for another episode of The Accidental Entrepreneur.
And so I ended up taking the job in Newburgh.
Okay.
This guy who actually worked for, the president of that company, was a golf fanatic. And I didn't play golf.
Oh, yeah.
And he said to me, do you play golf? After I was already hired, because he didn't even hire me. It was their HR department who hired me. And I said, nope, I don't play golf. He said, well, you got 3 months to learn or you're fired.
I was like, you had already had the job?
Right.
Okay.
So I said,
was golf getting big at that point? Is Tiger already playing?
Tiger was not that big yet.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but the issue was, I said to myself,
what the hell am I going to do this for? Right.
I said, why do I need to play golf? I'm running your sales and marketing. What does that have to do with golf? He said, everything. He said,
everything happens on the golf course.
He said, no pun intended, but there's more business done on the golf course than in the boardroom.
Right.
And you need to learn golf if you're going to run sales and marketing for our business.
Okay.
And so he taught me a lot about the game of golf and how business and golf are so correlated. And
so you literally got clubs. You went out with him to play golf.
Never
played before?
I never played golf before, but here's what was really peculiar. This company sent out all the males of their organization once a week to play golf for 9 holes of golf every Monday.
To practice?
No, to play golf with customers? No, with each other.
Okay.
He wanted everyone in the company to know each other.
To learn golf, and he used that as a way to
spend time together. He wanted everyone to know each other so that the finance people would learn them, know about the manufacturing people.
Right.
It was bonding and learning about their people and getting to know them and their job.
Team building, basically. That was his team
so
building
every
exercise.
Monday, every male, no, yeah. every female had to stay back and answer phones and do that.
Right. Yeah, it was,
so, but
you think it was
male,
like Mad Men in the 1950s, but it's mid-80s talking, right?
So I had to learn how to play golf.
Yeah.
But I never got a lesson. So I learned on the course.
Yeah.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
I am Dan Pincus, a CEO of World Golf Network, and as well as I am the president of Our Lunch Club.
All right, Dan, thanks for joining me today on the podcast. So I know you came down all the way from Bergen County. I appreciate you coming because we could have done this remotely, but I find it better when we're, you know, in a room together talking. This
Definitely.
Isn't live radio.
Yes.
So why don't we start with, before we get into World Golf Network and all the stuff you're doing, you know, where you grew up, what your background is, how you got interested in business. I know you have a big marketing background and sales and so forth. So why don't we start there?
Sure. So I grew up in Bergen County, Paramus, New Jersey. And I got an undergraduate degree from Clark University in economics.
Okay.
And have an MBA from Fairleigh Dickinson in marketing. When I started out of school in Clark University, my first job was in retail. I worked at a small company called Lord & Taylor.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Well, they have their main flagship stores in Westfield, although there's rumors it might close someday because somebody bought the company.
Well, I was at their flagship on 38th and 5th, and that has closed.
That has closed, right.
Yes.
That's right near Saks, right in that area, or maybe south of the...
It's actually south.
South of the library, right?
Yes,
yeah,
just
I remember
where
it was.
Right, yeah.
I used to work on 39th. So this was before you got your MBA, right?
This is before I got my MBA. It was
okay.
1986.
Okay.
So I got a job as the floor manager on the main floor on 5th Avenue. And my first job out of school, the activity was pretty hectic and fast-paced. My job was to make sure that not only were there enough salespeople on the floor, but that if any problems were going on the floor, I had to take care of them. I was a manager that people would call.
Yeah, so this is traditional retail.
Yes.
Those are big box stores in those days.
Exactly.
Right?
So
okay.
It was
Macy's, Lord
yes,
& Taylor, Bambergers.
All the big ones
right.
were there, yes. Right.
Gimbel's.
Yeah. Back in the day. So,
right.
So with that said...
And you said that was about 86?
86.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah, so I was right out of school, 21 years old. I actually reported to someone who literally was doing lines of cocaine every
perfect.
Day. So the energy level was high. You had to keep that energy level high, which probably is why I have a lot of energy today.
Right. But you did that without cocaine.
I did it without the cocaine.
Okay, that's good.
So it was just an experience that gave me the energy and the stamina to really to be on my feet all day and to run around and get things done.
Right.
And that was my first job out of school. And that was my setting pace of how I thought business was.
Right.
My next job was actually...
And that was like more management than sales, right? You were managing the sales
people. It was all management.
People.
There was no sales. I actually would just make sure there was enough coverage on the floor.
Got
it. I would take care of any customer problems. I was managing the main floor of Fifth Avenue.
Now, you think nowadays they would take a 21-year-old kid to do that?
I don't know.
Lord and Taylor in the
it
city?
It was considered
for
an executive
time,
training. It was an executive training program.
Okay.
It went through like a few weeks of training, and then they put you to the wolves. And
there you go.
You sink or swim.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's how it was.
Right.
And it was a great experience. My next job actually was at Manufacturers Hanover Trust, which is no longer around.
Yeah, no, they got bought by Chase, I think, right?
Yeah, it was back in the 80s when, again, they had all the South American loans that went bad and things changed.
There you go.
So, again, I went into an executive training program because you're promised when you're a college kid that if you go through an executive training program, you're going to go up the ranks.
Right.
So you believe everyone.
They
when
sell
you're
that to you and you're
yeah,
like,
you
believe
it.
It.
Yeah,
you
believe
don't
it.
Know.
So my start off in business was very... corporate, very employee-based.
Okay.
And at a very young age, I realized that I was not really fit for corporate America.
Yeah, me too. When I was young, I was like, how could I do this for the rest of my life working for somebody?
Right. So so while I was at the bank, Manufacturers Hanover Trust, they were paying for my MBA to go to school at night.
Oh, okay. And that was also in Manhattan?
That was in Manhattan.
So you're going, working in Manhattan?
No. My school was in Fairleigh Dickinson, New Jersey.
Yeah, out in Jersey.
But I lived in New Jersey. So when I came home, I would go to college, right? Go to the MBA.
So that was a night program?
It was a night program.
So you're working in the city of the day. You're going back out to Jersey after you back home.
But actually, pace-wise, I was
fine.
Young, I was used to working crazy hours at retail.
Yeah, and you're young.
So now at a bank, 9 to 5, I have all this extra
easy,
time.
Easy, right.
Get a work.
Exactly. Those days, then banks weren't open 7 days a week. It was a different world.
It was a very different world.
Right, okay.
So it was great.
And you're young. So
I was young, yeah. So I did that. And then what happened was I was really bored with the bank. Banking is, I mean, not for bankers that are out there. I'm sure it's great. But for what I was doing, I was actually managing bank products.
Right.
Lockbox, managed balance accounts, all different things which are bank products. My job was to work between the sales team and the customer service to find out what's going on, right and wrong with the products, how to make the products sell better, and work with both sides.
Don't bang the table. I think you bang.
All right. So my point was is that...
But you're right. Banking's a very
slow.
It's even slower now. It's like you walk in, they're playing bingo in the, you know, it's really, you go into the lobby, it's so quiet. I can't even imagine working there now. Then at least there was activity. There were people coming into the bank, right?
Well, yeah. But I was working not on the retail side of things. I was working at corporate.
Okay.
So I was actually behind the scenes of everything, and I was not...
You weren't dealing directly with customers.
Correct.
You were doing stuff behind.
The only time I dealt with customers was when I ran focus groups and actually brought them in to learn about what's going on right now.
Okay.
So back then, like I said, I was bored out of my mind, quite honestly. So in addition to getting my MBA, I actually started a business.
Okay.
And I started a business called International Sweaters. And what I did was, this is back when Benetton was very popular.
Yeah, I remember Benetton.
So I believe that it would be kind of a cool idea to travel around the world and bring sweaters from around the world to this one location and be able to sell to people whatever they wanted from around the world.
Okay.
So I called the company International Sweaters. My tagline was, if it isn't is, it isn't.
If it isn't is, it isn't. Okay.
Okay, International Sweaters is.
Yeah, right. I got it. Play on words.
Right. So
now, also, I don't mean to interrupt you.
Sure.
When you're getting your MBA, is there a concentration or a major, like it's just an MBA, or is it focused on sales or marketing or whatever?
Yeah. So my undergrad was in economics, and my MBA was in marketing.
Okay, makes sense. So now you're starting a business while you're getting your MBA in marketing.
Correct.
Okay, good. Just to give me an idea of where everything was going on.
Sure. So
because it all comes together at some point.
Exactly. Right? So I ended up leaving the bank and going full time with my sweater business.
Okay.
And I expanded from having a sweater business to just doing an entirely international import business.
Okay. They expanded. It wasn't just sweaters.
Right. Because I felt it was too seasonal to have just sweaters.
Okay. Makes sense. Right.
So,
you're wearing sweaters in July.
Right. So I ended up buying leather goods from Colombia and Argentina. And I bought Indian silk purse bags from India.
And at this point, you had your MBA, right? You finished that up at the bank?
I actually finished myself for the last year.
Okay.
Because I just was impatient.
You just couldn't
impatient.
Deal with it.
I was impatient.
Pass up the tuition reimbursement.
Yeah. I was impatient.
Okay.
So I ended up doing this for myself. I traveled to Argentina and worked my way up to Mexico. Okay. And I would actually spend about 3 months traveling, buying from all
just
the different...
looking for sourcing products,
yes,
basically.
And I was dealing with the manufacturers directly.
Okay.
So I started by actually going to the embassies in New York City and talking to the people who were representing the countries here in Manhattan, so I don't have to just go cold.
Right.
And they would actually give me the...
They connect you with
people,
right?
Yeah, they would tell me all the manufacturers down there, yeah. And I would actually go down there and travel and meet with them, and I would buy from them to have them send up... And I was living at home at the time, my parents... I'd send all the stuff that I was buying to my parents' house.
Right.
And I bought a retail store in Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Okay.
And I ended up selling out of that store. And then I started selling wholesale because I was buying directly from the manufacturer to other stores.
Okay.
And so this is basically the old, you know, the old tchotchke business in when the people say in the Jewish thing.
Right.
But I was buying clothing, leather goods, wall hangings. I bought before it became popular something called a Baja, which is a Mexican shirt, which has a hood and a pocket in front of your shirt, and it was made out of cotton. And okay. In Mexico, it was very popular, called a Baja. They sold for about $15 a shirt.
I think I know what you mean. They get, sometimes they're striped and whatever.
Well, yeah, back then it was a solid color.
Okay.
And usually it was cream color. And
it had sleeves, right?
It had sleeves, long sleeves.
Like a hoodie.
Right, like a hoodie, right.
But made out of whatever material they used
there.
It
was made out of cotton. It was almost like burlap.
Okay, yeah.
I didn't know they were going to become popular, but I ended up buying them because I was seeing all different things and I was buying things that I liked. And what I did was, when I had my store, I always felt I had a marketing background and I wanted to use my marketing background.
Sure.
So what I did was I made my store different from the average store. What I did was I would actually combine different countries to make products. So
okay.
As an example, for the Baja, not only did I sell regular Bajas from Mexico, I would have embroidered Bajas from Guatemala, send the Bajas from Mexico to Guatemala, have them embroider on top of that, and then sell them as custom Bajas.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
And so now...
And you're bringing them business. They wouldn't...
Exactly.
Yeah, they weren't accessing.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was doing that, and then I also... Another thing I did was I had... like, Italy had amazing designers, but they didn't have amazing leather. So I had Argentinian leather sent to Italy to have them design these jackets.
Oh, wow.
And what was also cool was that back then... There was no insulated leather jackets. They were all thin leather jackets.
Yeah.
So I actually had them insulate the leather jacket with some sort of a down to make it a warm leather jacket.
Right.
And that was like the coolest thing, because you could have your own leather down jacket.
Yeah, right. And it'd be warm, actually.
Right. And so that was, again, this is all back then. And the last thing I did, which was pretty cool, was in Greece, I bought sweaters. And actually, what I would have the kids in Ridgewood would actually go to my store and pick colors they wanted, that they wanted to have designed their own sweaters.
And then you would have the guys
and
in Greece make
them. And I would have them make them. And I would, once I had them.
How long would it take?
Well, I usually told them it was a 90-day wait period.
Oh, okay.
And then in 90 days, whatever orders I had, I'd send them to the manufacturer, and then I'd have them deliver the sweaters. So that the kids could actually design their own sweaters, which is kind of
cool.
Right,
because they all want their own stuff. They don't want to be wearing the same thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that was pretty cool. And then, I used all my marketing background to basically, you know, sell through the store. So my first year...
But you had a retail store and you sold
And I sold wholesale as well, right.
Okay.
And I also went to shows and like fairs and I actually brought my stuff to these places and sold as well there.
Yeah, okay.
So I did pretty well. I mean, my first year I grossed about $50,000, which is not bad for a kid. I was
How 20, old were you then?
24 years old.
Okay. That was a lot of money. You're living at your parents. You got no expenses.
Right.
You're living like a king.
Yes, it wasn't bad, right?
Right.
So so what happened was I was in a store where the rent went up triple.
Okay.
Where I was subleasing from the master landlord.
Okay.
I had this lower level of the store, and he gave me half his upfront window. He said, "Listen, I'm having to leave because I'm tripling my rent," and so I was paying $1,500 a month.
Right.
His rent was $4,000 a month, and he was now raised to $12,000 a month.
Yeah, he can't operate.
So he said, "I'm leaving. You're welcome to take it over. I'm not going to go up 10 times in price."
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So I made a name for myself in the town of Ridgewood.
Okay.
But because the rent went so crazy, I was like, I have to find someplace else to go.
Okay.
So I actually verbally got an agreement. This is why lawyers are good.
Yeah.
I verbally got an agreement with a landlord that I would take over another space in Ridgewood.
Okay.
And that place had double the amount of space that I had. And I had both upstairs and downstairs now.
Okay.
And the rent was going to $3,000 a month, which is the only double.
Yeah, it wasn't going to be 12.
Right. It was a great deal, relatively speaking. So I felt I could do that because I was making 50 grand. I could do that. But, you know, what happened was, when I went on a buying trip and I went from Argentina all the way up to Mexico to buy different things.
Yeah.
When I came back with all my merchandise and ready to go to my store, there was someone in my storefront. And so I went to the landlord and said,
In the new place.
Yes. So I said, "What's going on? You promised me that I would have this place." And he said to me, "Well, we have a verbal agreement, and that agreement is no longer valid because we have someone now who's in there, but they're only here month to month. I will honor an agreement if you match the price that they're paying for us.
Which was more than $3,000.
Which was well more. It was like $4,500. It was like 50%
more. It was more than you could afford.
And I was like, I'm not going to end up losing money for running this business. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And it was also during a time, it was late 80s, when actually retail was actually not doing so amazing. It was actually on the, it was kind of like having a bit of trouble.
Right.
And so even though I was doing fine and things were great, I said, you know what? I'm not going to struggle so hard for this.
Yeah.
It's maybe not meant to be. So I ended up coming out of the business altogether.
Oh, you did left it completely.
That's it completely. So I ended up going back to work. I finished my MBA at night.
Okay.
And I actually got a job as a head of marketing and sales for a manufacturing company up in Newburgh, New York.
Oh, okay.
And that's actually where I learned the game
that's
of golf.
That's up the thruway, right? Up in like exit 17, something like that, Newburgh?
Yeah, it's actually one exit north of the Woodbury Commons.
Right, Harriman. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So anyway, so I was living at the time. Actually, I had two job offers. I had that job offer and a job offer for BMG Music and Video.
Yeah, didn't they have a music club similar
yes,
to Columbia?
Correct.
For a while, yeah.
So they offered me that job to run the music and video department
okay.
in Long Island. But because I lived in New Jersey, my family was there, my friends were there, and I actually was dating my wife at the time.
Okay.
I said, do I want to move to Long Island and lose everything and
right.
everyone I know, or do I want to take a job up in Newburgh, New York, which is not close either. It was an hour drive north. But I said
you were going to stay in Bergen County
yes.
and commute.
Correct.
Okay.
So
you're still
I was still young. So I ended up getting an apartment in Mahwah, which is like on the northern tip of Jersey.
Right.
And it was an hour drive each way, and that was
so
fine
bad.
By me.
Right.
And so I ended up taking the job in Newburgh.
Okay.
This guy who actually worked for, the president of that company, was a golf fanatic. And I didn't play golf.
Oh, yeah.
And he said to me, do you play golf? After I was already hired, because he didn't even hire me. It was their HR department who hired me. And I said, nope, I don't play golf. He said, well, you have 3 months to learn or you're fired. I said, what are you doing?
Like, you had already had the job?
Right.
Okay.
So I said,
was golf getting big at that point? Is Tiger already playing?
Tiger was
golf
not
was
really.
A
it was
dead
not. It was not
he,
that big yet.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but the issue was, I said to myself,
what the hell am I going to do this for, right?
I said, why do I need to play golf? I'm running your sales and marketing. What does that have to do with golf? He said, everything. He said, no
right.
pun.
Everything happens on the golf course.
He said, no pun intended, but there's more business done on the golf course than in the boardroom.
Right.
And you need to learn golf if you're going to run sales and marketing for our business.
Okay.
And so he taught me a lot about the game of golf and how business and golf are so correlated.
So you literally got clubs. You went out with him to play golf. You
no,
never played before?
I never played golf before, but here's what was really peculiar. This company sent out all the males of their organization once a week to play golf for 9 holes of golf every Monday.
To practice or
no,
with,
to play
with
golf.
Customers?
No, with each other.
Okay.
He wanted everyone in the company to know each other.
To learn golf, and he used that as a way to
no, he didn't want, it wasn't
spend
about learning
time
golf.
Together.
He wanted everyone to know each other so that the finance people would learn the know about the manufacturing people.
Right.
And
it was bonding and learning
yes.
about their people and getting
yes.
to know them
and
the job.
Yes.
Sure.
And some and
team
was,
building,
yes,
basically.
Exactly.
That was his team
so
building
every
exercise.
Monday, every male, no,
yeah.
every female had to stay back and answer phones and do that.
Right. Yeah, it was,
so, but
you think it was
male,
like Mad Men in the 1950s, but
right.
it's mid-80s you're talking, right?
Yeah, so I had to learn how to play golf.
Yeah.
But I never got a lesson. So I learned on the course.
Yeah.
And they were very particular about everything, how you play the game. They would watch every stroke and everything you did. And whether you were good or bad, you were taking every single stroke. So I was the worst golfer because I never had a lesson.
Right.
And I never played before.
Yeah.
So I got 110. I don't know if you know anything about golf, but I got 110 strokes for 9 holes of golf.
That is
like
a lot.
Horrendous.
That's 220.
Yes. But now,
I think my worst day was a 130.
Yes.
Stop counting at
so
one.
So this was, now I played on a course which was all uphill and all downhill. So there was no.
This is upstate New York. A lot of the courses
not
up
upstate
there are
New
like
York,
that.
But it was like, it was above Rock. It was Orange County, New York.
Okay.
So.
A lot of mountain courses in up.
Yeah,
up
it was all mountain, up and
yeah.
up and down. So I didn't know anything different. This is the game yeah. I was learning. But I got most improved golfer. I went from a 110 to a 55. After 1 year of playing with us.
That's on 9 holes.
On
so
nine
now
holes.
You're down to 110
exactly.
for a full round.
Right.
Okay. You got to break 100.
So that was it. But that's as good as I got in that group there. But
okay.
But that's how I got into the game of golf, just to let you know.
Okay. That makes sense. And then you followed that through. So now you're working in Newburgh.
Correct.
For this guy doing sales and marketing for this company.
Right. So I actually, this is an interesting story. So I was running their sales and marketing, but I wasn't that bright. Okay. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just out of MBA school. My background has nothing to do with what they were doing.
Right.
And I was going to run their whole sales and marketing.
This
was a $20 million company, which
okay.
is not huge.
No, but this was 30 years, 40 years ago?
This is back
yeah.
in the 80s, yes.
Yeah, okay.
89, I think it was. No, I'm sorry, 91.
Okay.
So anyway, so the so what happened was I said to myself, I'm not going to take this whole thing on myself. I'm going to be smart enough to hire a marketing consultant to help us with this project.
Okay.
So I
they let you do that?
They let me do that.
Okay.
So I hired a guy who was like really bright. He was from Yale University. He also went to he had a military background, and he was like really, really sharp guy, which I interviewed.
Yeah.
And I said, you're the guy who's going to help us. He trained me how to do marketing.
Perfect.
He was better than my MBA school.
Yeah, it's funny that how that works, right? You learn nothing in school. It's like a thinking exercise. Law school is the same way. You do not learn how to practice law in law school.
Right.
You don't even learn how to take the bar.
Right.
Well, I missed evidence because of some scheduling issue. I was freaking out. It's not a requirement, but so the guy said, don't worry about it. You'll learn it in the bar review course. And I did. I learned it. It was funny, but that's the way life works,
that's
right?
That's the way life works.
Yeah.
So I literally got my hard knocks from this consultant,
right,
who I, thank God, I was smart to figure out to hire this guy,
right,
to help me.
He's like, I can't do this on my own.
Yeah. So
okay,
he helped me do everything, and I learned a lot from this guy.
Okay.
And so, anyway, so we actually ended up getting the second biggest. The company was a filtration and felt company. They manufactured felt and filtration products.
Do those go together?
They could. So one is actually like, if you think of like the pool tables, they have felt on them.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
Filtration is like air filtration and liquid filtration of cleaning and getting things which are like
like HVAC units or
correct,
those kind of filters.
Getting things which are like HEPA units, which are,
yeah,
you know, it's very.
So they're like really two divisions. They're kind
correct,
of
correct. Two
separate
divisions. 100%. No, they weren't exactly the,
okay,
same. So anyway, so they actually the reason I was hired actually as a VP of sales and marketing is they actually got the patent for a product out of England, which was considered the best air filtration product in the world.
They had bought the patent,
they bought
the
patent, licensed
it, or something.
The rights to manufacture.
Okay, they probably licensed it. Okay.
And they wanted me to go out and basically market this thing.
Okay.
So I had to go out and do an international study.
And you know nothing about filtration,
right,
products.
So I had to learn on the job, so I hired,
okay,
this guy and he helped me.
Yeah.
And we did an international study and did actual testing on all the filtration products out there in the world.
Okay.
And had independent testing laboratories give us samples to see how do we stack up to everybody else.
Now, he was a smart guy too, but did he know anything about filtration? Was he in the industry?
He wasn't in the industry, but he was really smart and he was in the business for many years and he knew what to do and how to do it.
Okay.
And he trained me.
Good.
So anyway, the point is that we ended up not only testing all the products out, we were like actually tied for the best product in the world. The other one was in Japan.
Okay.
And because nothing was being distributed in the United States, we had the best product in the United States of America.
It made it easier.
So what we did was we said, rather than us try and make and sell the product, we're going to go out to the big air filtration companies and have them sell it for us. We'll manufacture it,
right,
and we'll make a partnership.
Right. You're looking for distributors, basically.
Exactly. So we actually interviewed the top air filtration companies in the country.
Okay.
And the second largest one wanted to work with us.
Okay.
And they gave us an agreement that said that if we can, you know, they want to see our production facilities before they agree to this.
Right.
And if they see that we can produce the product, they'll be happy to sign the agreement. And then we basically will have them as a partner and they'll go out and market the product for us.
Okay.
Now, as I mentioned to you, this company, I don't know if I told you, was $20 million in sales.
Yeah, you said that. Yep.
The production
was 30 years ago. So that's,
yes,
significant.
Well, not that significant, but it was a mid-sized firm. So
okay.
And it was an old firm. It was actually used to be owned by GAF, which was a big company at the time.
Right, I remember GAF.
So this company had to invest $40 million into the facilities to build out the equipment to manufacture this because it was only a prototype. It wasn't ready for manufacturing.
Oh, so they got the patent,
yes,
and it wasn't like, so they needed to build,
they had to build
out
the manufacturing facilities.
Wow.
For this.
Okay.
So that was $40 million in
costs. Twice their gross revenue.
Correct.
Okay.
And they said, we're not putting $40 million into a facility unless we have a signed agreement.
Right.
That you are if we're doing this, because what if you say, not, we're not going to do it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So there was a headlock because they wouldn't sign it without the
like,
the,
yeah,
without
it needed
the
to be a joint venture, really. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And
they didn't want to do it.
And they wouldn't go. And so basically, they said, well, we're not going to do it then.
Okay.
So I was like, then what am I here for?
Right.
So I ended up saying,
the patent's worthless because
exactly,
they're not going to invest the money.
Exactly. So I ended up leaving that company.
Okay.
I'm not going to go through every single job I had.
No, we don't have to do that.
So I'm going to skip.
Well, jump ahead. This is like early 90s, you said, right?
This is the early 90s.
Okay.
Yes.
So then let's jump ahead to, I guess, late 90s because we're getting close to the turn of the century before 9/11, right?
Right.
Okay. What were you doing then at
okay,
that point?
Okay. So. The last actually,
I mean, I'm happy to talk to you for four hours.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure
nobody listened to the podcast. It'll be too long.
So we'll jump to, like you said, to 99.
Okay.
I was actually working for an architectural firm. And at the time, I was using golf to actually grow business for this other company.
Yeah.
And I learned that golf was really a great way to grow business. And I not only did I was able to grow people's businesses using the game of golf, but one of the people that I was taking out for golf was a high-level manager at a construction firm and said, hey, you know, we need someone like you to help us with our marketing because we have no one really doing our marketing, and we're doing about $100 million in sales, but we have no one doing marketing for us. We have no brochures, no website.
And your firm was doing their architectural work.
And the firm that I worked for was basically what they were specialized in telecom equipment for the architectural industry. So they created, they put all the wireless towers out there around the country to basically get everyone to have a cell phone service. Okay. This is back in the late 90s.
Yeah.
So the marketing was going great. We had a very good name and they knew I ran the marketing for them. So they said, we would love to have you come and do our marketing. And I was like, well, I'll be happy to, you know, interview with your president to see if it makes sense. So I said, I'm not going to go. They were based in Manhattan and I was working in Jersey at the time. So I knew that I'm not going to go into Manhattan from Jersey unless I'm getting a jump in salary because
costs are going up. Yeah, of course.
Well, there's more time involvement. Yeah. There's more costs and everything else,
aggravation.
Right? So I said to myself, okay, but it's got to be worth my while or I'm not going to make the move. They said,
because you were going to have to leave your company to join them full time.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. So I said, let me know, I'm happy to meet with the president and see what he wants to do.
Right.
So the president was a very unique character. He had a pretty strong ego.
Okay.
And he basically was the kind of person which would not give you eye contact when he talked to you.
Oh, yeah.
He would actually be on his computer and say, well, what do you got?
Right. Oh,
and
boy.
He wouldn't even be looking at you.
He's still on his computer
while you're talking. And so when
when
I went into that interview, I didn't say a word.
Right.
I just was silent. And he said, I thought you were here to talk to me.
Because you're a sales guy, so you know. Okay.
So I said, I thought you were here to talk to me. I'm like, I'll be ready to talk to you when you're ready to talk to me.
Yeah.
So he was like, you got a lot of balls.
You're basically interviewing for this job?
Yes.
Okay, good. I like that. I like it's a good story.
So I said to him, I said, I'm not going to talk to you until you're going to talk to me.
Right. What do you need to be there for?
So he was like.
You still had a job, right? You didn't quit your other job.
100%. I had a job.
Okay, it's fine.
So I said to him, listen, when you're ready to talk, I'm ready to talk.
Okay.
So he looked at me like I was like crazy. Because
nobody's ever
talked to him. No one talks to him like this.
Right, of course.
Okay.
That's the problem.
Right. So he says to me, okay, then he literally puts his computer away. Okay, so now I have your attention. Is this okay for you? I said, this is okay for me.
That's better.
So we talked and I said to him, listen, tell me why you want me here to help you with sales and marketing. He said, I never said I wanted you here for sales and marketing because, again, he's got a position.
Yeah, it was not his idea.
Right. You're here because someone else, right?
Right.
I'm like, well, I was told that you needed someone here. I'm here to help if you want me to. But if you don't need me here, then I don't have to be here.
Right.
And so he, again, not used to someone basically telling him, rather he's used to telling people.
Right.
He said to me, all right, here's what we have going on. Tell me what you would do with this. So he had this basically unfinished brochure, which was like half done. He had no website. It was quote unquote under construction. If you remember back in the days when websites were under construction.
Right.
And there was nothing there. And I said, you have no marketing here, right. So you're giving me nothing.
Right,
here.
What are you going to do?
So you're telling me.
The problem is he's controlling everything, and he doesn't see the value in it. He's probably too busy. The whole e-myth we talked about at lunchtime.
Exactly.
Trying to do everything himself, which is a dangerous way to join a company. Got one guy really making all the decisions.
So I said to him, listen, he said to me, what are you going to bring me in sales? He says to me. I'm like, well, I'm going to bring you nothing in sales until you have no marketing
right,
here at all.
Yeah.
So I said, it's going to take me at least a year to develop your marketing. And once I've done your marketing, then I can start looking at your sales.
Okay.
I said, if you're willing to hire me for that, I'm willing to.
I think that's reasonable.
Well,
things don't happen overnight.
Well, not only that, but I'm not going to go out and sell when I have nothing to sell with.
2 months, he'll fire you because you didn't bring in any sales.
Exactly.
You'd be like, well, yeah.
So I said to him, this is the deal. I need a budget.
Right.
I said, here's what's going to cost you to get this done.
Yeah, you laid out the expectations right up front.
Exactly.
Okay.
I said, either you're going to give me a budget and work with you, and that's not touching my salary. Or you're not. And if
right.
you're willing to do that, then I'm willing to consider working with you.
Right. Yeah, can't touch
What do you
your
mean
salary,
willing to consider me, he says to me. I'm going to willing to consider you, he said to me.
Yeah, well, but you don't need him.
Right. So the point is that it's all about positioning.
Of course.
And I was in a situation, and I've always taken that position, and that's an entrepreneurial background.
Right.
I always had the position that I don't need this job. I don't need you. I can work on my own if you
right.
don't want me. If you want me,
that's
great.
A good mindset to have, even if you do need them.
Correct.
Because they'll smell that stuff in the water 100%. Like sharks. Yeah.
And so I basically said, listen, I'll take this. If you meet my expectations, I'm happy to work with you guys.
Okay.
And so they did, but I learned, again, I always learn lessons along the way.
Yeah.
I learned a lesson that you cannot make a contract with any subjectivity in it.
Yeah.
It's got to be objective. at all times on the contract.
Or if not, they're just going to see it differently than you do.
And then you'll never get anything that you want.
Right. Even that, sometimes it doesn't work.
So I actually took on the job with a nice base salary with a nice bonus structure. But the bonus structure was based on their subjectivity of if things are good enough.
Correct. And things of good enough is their opinion,
never
not
good
yours.
Enough, right?
Right.
So I ended up...
I thought you were going to do a million in sales. Million? We were talking about half a million. Well, I changed my mind. You know, that's...
Correct. So
subjectivity is not good.
Right.
A lot of trust you need.
So I'm not going to go into the business that I had, which was while I was there, which is the publishing business, which we talked about over lunch.
Right.
Because that will take you some more time. But I will jump into what I'm doing today.
Right. Okay.
So one of the things that I used was golf to actually grow business. So... on the second year of me working with that company, I said to them, I'm not going to take your subjectivity anymore for me getting a bonus. I want this to be an objective statement. If I do certain amounts of things, I get a certain amount of money.
Right. So you have the control.
Correct.
Right.
So I said to them, if I bring in you new business, what will you give me as a bonus for the new business I bring into the company?
Yeah.
And so he said to me, I don't want any business because I don't know if it's going to come from you or from other people. I want you to bring a business we don't even have anything to do with. So I want you to go into a new industry that we don't currently cover and bring in business.
Okay.
And that's not easy to do, but I can do it because I take on any challenge. I said, great, tell me the industry you want
to bring in. You said they were a construction company?
They were a construction firm.
Yeah, so they can almost build anything.
They can build, but...
Commercial.
Commercial. But the reality is that people want experience in their industry. They say, what have you built in my industry?
Right. Now, how many auto dealerships have you built? Well, you're the first. That's
exactly.
Tough sale.
Exactly.
Right.
So you need to know that going into this.
Right.
So I said, no problem. I said, I will bring in a new industry. Tell me the industry you want me to bring in. He wanted the number one hardest industry, which was pharmaceutical.
Right.
So he wanted me to build out pharmaceutical.
Well, he wants to make it as hard on you as possible.
100%.
Let's throw this kid out there and see what he can do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So with my marketing background, I'm not just a sales guy. I'm a marketing guy.
Right.
I said, I'm not going to bring in the sales the way I would go out and call on companies. I'm going to go to the top architectural and engineering firms who specialize in pharmaceutical work and do a deal with them that will refer them business in our industries if they refer us business in their industries.
That makes sense.
But in order to get those connections, I use the game of golf. Because how would – why do they want to talk to me?
Now, you started playing golf not at the architectural firm, like two jobs before this,
yes.
Right?
So the job before the architectural firm, I was working at that manufacturing firm.
Where they made you go play golf
Correct.
All the time.
Yes.
Okay. It's a good job. They go play golf.
Well, that wasn't my only
job.
That
was every Monday.
That wasn't my only part of the job, but yes. But my point, though, was that skill set allowed me to learn that I would interview – people on the golf course to see, do I want to work with you?
Right.
Or do you want to work with me? Do you like me? Do you care?
Yeah, you spend 3-4 hours with somebody.
So you learn if you're cheating, if you're honest. You learn all about that person, right?
Correct.
So I said,
great. Yeah, they're cheating at golf. They're probably cheating at a lot of other
100%.
Things, too. Yeah.
So I ended up getting the number two biggest engineering firm in the country who specialized in pharmaceutical industry. They did over $1 billion in engineering and architectural work in pharmaceutical.
Right.
And they said that we'll give you as much work as you can handle as long as your price is competitive and as long as you do a good job.
And you had basically spent 4 hours with this guy on the golf course.
It wasn't just 4 hours. I actually was taking him out for golf a number of times.
Okay.
So how it works,
that's fair. You get $1 billion account. It's got to take a couple of times, right?
Yeah. So I how I did it was that the first time I took them out for golf, they didn't want to play with me. Who am I? They don't
want
to play with
me.
So I would keep calling them and pestering them until they said yes. I said, you play with me golf once, I won't ask you again. And I paid for the whole expenses of playing golf with them.
And you're in, what, your mid-30s at this point?
I was in my early 30s.
Early 30s. Okay,
yes.
Fine.
So I would say mid-30s maybe. But
okay.
So I was basically taking them out for golf. And what happened was I said to him, listen, I'm not going to ask you up for golf again. You came out with me. I appreciate that. Thanks for the golf. You know, good luck with everything. And hopefully good luck, you know.
Yeah.
And then more than half the time they'd say to me, I had a great time. If you want to play golf again, no problem.
Right.
Because they liked me.
Yeah. Well, likability is a big part of the process.
If they didn't like me, they would have said, we're done, right?
Yeah, right. It, you know.
But if they liked me, that means they're also going to give me business.
Yeah, of course.
So what happened was when they said to me, let's play again, I didn't have to ask for the business. I knew they were going to be my client.
Right, because likability builds trust and people trust you.
It all came together, right?
Yeah, of course.
Right. So what happened was the second time I played golf with them, I still wouldn't talk about business.
Yeah.
But after the second round was over and they said, where are we playing for a third time? I say, now it's time for me to talk about business.
Here's the area. The door's now open. You've been with them two times.
Exactly.
Doesn't look like you're being, you know,
100%.
So,
but the point of the matter was that I knew him well enough now to say I can't keep playing golf without doing some business.
Right.
Because this is my job.
Right.
So
nor will he find that surprising that you would be going out on the golf course with him all the time and never bring up business. They'd be like, why does Dan keep going out on the golf course with us?
Right. So so that now
they know how it's
they're ready for it now.
Of course.
And they're not going to say, no, we're not going to give you any business after playing golf with you twice and want to play a third time.
No.
So I already have them as a client.
Yeah.
But I don't know how good of a client they're going to be.
Yeah, right.
So the issue was that this guy gave me the magic words. We'll give you as much business as you could handle. That is like the best every, words you could ask for.
You always want to hear that.
Right?
Yeah.
So I was
He wasn't even expecting a quid pro quo with business back, even though you probably could have brought him some business?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Because he said, we have so much work to
right.
do.
His,
give
his,
work
he
anyway.
Doesn't need more work.
Why not give it to someone who I like?
Right.
Right?
Yeah, you built a relationship
right.
with him.
So he said to me, listen, we'll give you as much work as you can handle as long as it's competitive and do a good job. So I was like, okay, great. So I said, would you give me that in writing? Because I've learned.
You want to be able to show.
I don't take any verbal things anymore because I don't know what's real.
That screwed you before in Ridgewood.
Exactly.
Out of your store. Yeah.
So I said, can you put that? He said, I'll do better than that. I will go to your office. I'll talk to your president directly and I'll tell it to him face to face. How's that? I'm like, let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. You look like a king.
Right. So I brought him over, set up the meeting. You know what the president of my company says to this guy?
Now, wait. This is the guy that wouldn't look up from his computer when you met him. Oh, boy. Here we go.
He says to me, Dan, you don't, this guy doesn't tell me the price. I tell him the price. I have an estimating department. I'll tell him the price of whatever it's going to cost to do it.
You're like, oh my God.
That was the end of it. I lost it.
Yeah.
He walked away and said,
I'm not dealing with this guy. I want to deal with you, but I don't want to deal with him.
Doesn't matter. He's the president.
Right.
So anyway, the point is I lost the deal. And when I saw that, I said, I'm done.
Yeah.
I said, I don't care.
That's the wrong guy to work for.
Right. So I said, I can't.
And, but you learned something. You saw what spending 4, 8, 12 hours on the golf course with somebody does.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I said at that point, actually, I had I mentioned a business I did before, which was a publishing business.
Right.
But I did that right after 9/11, which if you remember, had no marketing was like dead in the water and people weren't doing anything.
Right.
So that kind of put a little damper on that. So I actually was doing research on what was going on marketing wise. What do I want to do the rest of my life? Right.
Yeah.
And I said to myself,
this is just post 9/11.
This is just post 9/11, okay. And I joined a group called La Tip.
Yeah. It's like BNI. Right. They're like competitors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And actually, the reason I joined is because an architect that I knew was a member of this thing and said, Dan, you have a marketing background. You've had marketing businesses in the past. Why don't you go to these networking groups and market yourself to these people?
Right. Now, you didn't have a job at that point, right? You were like independent.
I went back on my own and started my marketing firm.
Okay. So, yeah.
So I had a marketing company and I was working with small to mid-sized companies doing the marketing.
It's kind of the way I got started too with BNI. Somebody invited me to a group. They're starting a group. They need a lawyer to be I think I was the estate planning lawyer.
Yes.
And I got started doing, networking. I don't know what I was doing.
Right. So I didn't know anything about networking.
Right.
So I learned actually how to network from this organization.
Yeah.
And
I got to say something. And this is like just post 9/11. Networking was really very new.
Yes.
At that point, because I was in actually this where I am, where we are now.
Yes.
15 years ago or 20 years ago, I was here.
Yes.
At working with them. And I went to this thing at Hyatt Hills. Mm-hmm. There's a restaurant there, whatever. It's been changed 6 times or something, whatever it was then.
Yes.
And I met this guy. He was working with a group called Network Plus.
Yes,
remember
that? Ted Fatteros.
Yeah, you remember Ted? Yes. You know, he
yes.
died a
I
number
know he
of years
did.
Ago.
Yes, he committed suicide, yes.
Is that how he died?
Yes.
Like in his mid-50s?
He was in his late 50s, yeah.
He was? Oh, yeah. So sad. But anyway, that was like my first. I didn't even know networking. I thought networking was like when you go into someone's office.
Actually, Ted Fatteros started his business in 2000, and I think it was 1 or 2.
Okay, makes sense, because probably about 4 or 5 was when I met this guy, Bruno. Do you know Bruno Genova?
I do know Bruno Genova.
Bruno's went back into law.
Yes.
So he was the first guy I met. And he said, listen, let's have lunch and I'll teach you how to network.
Excellent.
And he's the first guy I met. But
So actually, it's funny. You speak about the Ted Fatteros because actually there's something I learned from Ted Fatteros. I'll tell you that in a second. So when I joined La Tip, this was before PC Plus, before Network Plus was created. And I didn't know anything about networking. And my experience in networking was you have to give before you get, like all the groups say. And I said, okay, great. So I refinanced my mortgage with the mortgage guy. I did my insurance with the insurance guy.
Right.
I gave my 401k plan to the financial guy.
Right.
I gave everyone I could business.
Right, as much as you can from yourself.
From myself.
Yeah.
And I said, here you go. Here's everything I'm doing. Help me out, okay? And I spent a year networking, and I didn't get 1 ounce of business.
Really?
And I said to myself, maybe I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah, okay.
What could I be doing wrong? Because obviously,
you're trying to follow the formula, right?
So I said, I got to figure this out.
Is La Tip similar to BNI, where you come in, you got to have a slip for somebody, and you
same
refer?
Kind of thing.
Okay,
it's really almost identical.
Very structured.
Yeah, very
okay.
structured, right. So I said to myself, the only thing I could think of is that people don't understand what I do for them.
Okay.
And so they don't understand. How can they refer me? They don't understand what
right.
I do.
Right. They don't understand your business.
So I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop my prices by like 80% and offer my services to the people in this room as to write them a business plan for their companies. And for $500 basically, I offered them to write their business plan for them, which is really cheap.
So they can, yeah, they're 10 grand to
yes,
get these
exactly.
things done
so I
properly.
Said, it's really cheap. Yeah. I said, I'm going to give them a business plan and I'm going to show them what I could do for their business. And they could use that for themselves and not work with me at all.
But now they could learn what you do.
Right. And they understand what my value is for them and the people they know.
Okay.
I spent a year trying to get them to help me to do a business plan. I mean,
they wouldn't even do it.
They wouldn't do that.
Yeah. People go in the group. They don't want to spend any money.
$500? Yeah. I was like, if you're not willing to spend $500 on a business
plan, it's not worth your time.
Why am I here?
Right.
So I said to myself, I do understand networking, but I understand I'm also in the wrong place for networking.
Yeah.
So I said, let me research networking. And this is, again, back in 2001, 2002 area, right? I researched every networking group out there.
There weren't a lot in those days.
There weren't a lot.
Right?
But there was
a Meetup
and
Eventbrite and all this stuff.
There was a whole
stuff.
Lot less than there is today. A whole
yeah,
lot less.
Whole
like
lot
80%
less,
yeah. right? But there were some networking groups out there, and they were really old-fashioned established groups.
Yeah.
Like there was the Elks Club.
Yeah.
And there was the VFW. You know,
ABA even around? Bob Putt?
ABA was not around
not yet.
Yeah,
that's what I thought.
So interesting, all these people you're mentioning.
Yeah, but, because of John. I met all these people.
Correct.
Yeah.
So what I did was I researched everything, and this is when Ted Fatteros just started his group, before ABA, actually.
Yeah.
In 2002. Now, ABA started actually in Long Island before it was in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So when it was... ABA already was in Long Island.
But it wasn't Bob.
It was a guy by the name of Gene and Ellen who owned the business actually altogether.
Okay.
And they were, I didn't even know them at the time, but I met Ted Fatteros from researching all the networking, and he just started his networking group, Network Plus.
Right.
And he taught me something about networking which no one else taught me about, which was that most networking is closed networking, meaning that people join these groups as being the only doctor
right.
or lawyer or accountant
realtor,
or banker.
Plumber,
right.
electrician.
And if you join my group, you'll be the only one, so you'll get all the business. So join now so you can lock everyone else out.
Yeah, but that doesn't,
right?
Yeah.
That's how they teach you networking in all these BNIs, LATIFs,
of course.
And other groups. Ted Fatteros was, in my opinion, very smart in the respect that he was thinking out of the box.
Right.
He said, that is not the best way to
network. Well, it didn't work for you already. You have an example.
Correct.
Right?
So I learned one thing from him, which is really powerful, was that open networking is so much better than closed networking.
Because you have to build relationships with people.
Correct. So here's what he taught me. The more networking you do, the more people you know, the more valuable you are to everyone else.
Right.
And so you should
not... In terms of bringing them resources or introductions, right.
And by the way, if you're an accountant, just because you're an accountant doesn't mean you're good at every part of accounting.
Of course not.
So if I can introduce someone who's good for you,
yeah.
but I have another accountant who's better for someone else... I look better to refer that guy to him and someone else to you.
Even if you're doing business together, you
Correct.
Can only do so much business between the two of you.
Yes.
And then that's
so
over.
The abundance, there's enough business out there for
right.
everybody.
Yeah.
And you should all share and help each other.
Correct.
And you'll all do better for it.
Yeah. I don't care if there's other attorneys in the room.
Correct.
I got a personality. I want to meet people.
Exactly.
Grow my network.
Now, what I figured out from what he said to me, and this is my personal intake, was if you're afraid of competition, it means one of two things. Either you have an issue that you're not good enough,
right?
That you're afraid that someone else is going to get your business from you,
right?
Or
it's not a good way to operate.
No, or you have this really crazy thinking that because you're in this group, everyone's going to start referring you business,
right?
Now,
just because you joined
this group,
yeah, which is ridiculous,
right?
Yeah.
So I said to myself, you know what? Ted had a great point, and I really believe in Ted's philosophy over the BNI and LATIF philosophies.
Yeah,
I believe that. You can't have too much competition, of course, because then it's not valuable. But a little competition is actually healthy and valuable.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, if you think about the restaurant business, if you own an Italian restaurant, a lot of smart restaurateurs will actually open up a Japanese
Nearby.
Restaurant
yeah.
or something right next door because people want a choice.
Correct.
They don't want to go to the same place over
right.
again.
Right. It's not like this guy's stealing my business because
right.
everybody's got to eat dinner. They're
and
not going to go and have Italian every night.
Right. If you have a choice of more than one place,
right.
you're going to go there again.
Because then, plus you're going to, you know that area.
Yes.
So you go to the Japanese place and you go, oh, you know what? Let's go to Luigi's tonight.
Exactly.
That's what happens. They nest
yes.
in areas.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the point.
Those are
is
the
that,
smart restaurateurs.
That's right. So my point again comes back to the fact that that's what one of the things I learned about networking, which is really
Good.
Powerful. So I learned that from Ted, and I joined his group at the time when I was in marketing.
Yeah, me too.
And then what happened was I said to myself, you know what? First of all, no one is using the game of golf
right.
to actually build relationships. And golf is nothing better than golf relationships.
Right.
So I said, wouldn't it be a cool idea to actually find out who needs to meet who, match them up on the golf course so they can spend 4 to 5 hours together,
right,
and get build a relationship and do business together.
Right.
I did that for every other company. I said, why don't I do it for everybody else?
Right.
So I came up with the idea, let me create my own networking group.
Yeah.
Where I will—
focused on golf.
But what I was doing, which what most networking groups didn't do, is I said, I don't want to deal with the everyday person. I want this to be decision makers only.
Like serious people.
It's not about serious people. It's people who can make a decision.
Makes
people
sense.
Who actually can write a check,
right,
and say, let's do something.
Yeah.
Versus, let me get my boss to see if it's okay.
Yeah, well, that's not, yeah.
Right. So that, but that's the way most networking is.
I know.
If you go to a typical chamber, you go to a typical general networking group, you'll meet probably 2/3 of the people will be salespeople.
Right.
And 1/3 will be very small business owners.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, even the small business owners don't have a lot of money.
Oh, half the time the chamber, they don't want to pay $150 to,
right,
join the chamber.
Right.
We would deal 5 towns. You're going to meet people. It's,
right,
$150.
So the reality, I believe, is that the problem was when I was doing the networking was that it wasn't that networking doesn't work. It only works when you're with the people who are relevant for you and have the ability to help you.
Makes sense.
So I said to myself, I've got to qualify out the people who are not going to be of value to the people in the room.
Right.
So that, to me, time is worth much more than money.
Right.
Because you can always get money back. You can never get your time back.
Right.
So I said to myself, I want to deal with people who are successful, who actually value time more than they value money. And they want me to help them get in front of the right people. And they want me to help them make connections, but not just here's an introduction, but here's a relationship. So I said to myself, how do people build relationships? It's based on socialization. So just like,
right,
golf,
okay,
the only way you really get to know someone is if you know, like, and trust them, right?
Right.
How does that happen? Not from going to a meeting and having breakfast.
Spending time together.
But it's more than spending time. It's getting engaged with them. So I created a program which was socialized. So everything I do is not about learning. It's about enjoying each other's time,
like,
and getting to know
each
other.
Like having an experience together.
Correct.
And spending time.
So whether it be golf or whether
sharing,
it be a poker event or,
yeah,
whether it be a cocktail event, it's getting to know each other and start building, seeing each other regularly and getting to know each other.
Right.
And talk to each other and build and get to know your families and your friends. And let's do I care about you?
Right.
If I don't care about you, why,
no,
am I doing business with you?
Correct.
So to me, I basically took, in my opinion, the networking to a different level where I said, let's get the decision makers out to meet each other, build a relationship together, and now naturally do business together. And in that environment, I felt everyone could do business.
Yeah.
Now the issue is that it costs a lot more money to do that.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So I
just
knew—
just getting them on the golf course is expensive.
Well, even forget about golf. Even going to a nice cocktail event. I actually,
right,
went to the best restaurants I can get into.
Yeah.
I went to the Palm. I went to Morton's.
Right.
I went to the best places because I wanted it,
right,
to be a great experience. I don't want it to be, oh, here's another diner or another place.
Yeah, but you can't charge people $10 to come to Morton's.
It costs more. It costs more to run it.
Right.
So I said, listen, you got— I'm a big believer in basically giving it away until it actually works, to show people it works.
Yeah, okay.
But I also believe you can't lose money. Otherwise,
no,
you go out of
business.
No,
because that's not sound business.
Correct.
Yeah.
So I believe give it away in the beginning at cost and then eventually raise your prices to show, okay, now that's, I got to get paid for my time.
Right.
So my theory was, let me start off at my cost and I'll raise my prices every year. And as I raise my prices, now I'm getting paid for my work.
Makes sense.
And I would grandfather them based on when they joined.
Right.
So the earlier you get in, the cheaper it's going to be.
Yeah, okay.
And that's how I built the business.
Well, they got confidence and faith in you.
Right.
They get in and they stick with it.
That's it.
Yeah. All right. So this kind of went a good full circle. So now your business is networking.
Correct.
So if somebody is either new to networking or they're in business a while, what kind of advice do you give people? You meet somebody, I don't understand this whole networking thing. Maybe you're prospecting them for your business. Maybe,
correct,
you're just giving them advice. What kind of things do you tell people,
right,
in terms of advice about networking?
The first point of it's actually really about their personality. I need to get to know their personality before I can even accept them as a member. So a lot of people are transactionally based. In fact, I would say most people are transactionally based.
Right. You're going to pay the fee, you're in.
No, it's not about paying a fee and getting in. It's about, if I give you $500 or $100 or $1,000 or whatever the number is,
right,
what do I get back for that money?
Right. Okay.
They're transactionally based.
Yeah, that,
okay,
makes sense.
They feel, I'm paying you money, what do I get for this money?
Right.
And in that mindset, networking does not work well. Because in that mindset, you feel like you have a timeline. If you don't get a certain amount of business in a certain period of time,
right,
you're leaving.
Yeah.
So you already have this negative structure set into your place that people are looking at you like, this guy is like selling.
He's always measuring.
Yeah, and he's also, the mindset is that you're always selling because, is this worth it? Is this worth it? You're constantly qualifying, questioning everything. If you don't believe in something, you shouldn't go into it in the first place, in my opinion. So you need to first understand, what is networking?
Right.
And so I tell people that networking is not selling. but most people think it is.
Right.
Most people think that if I go to network, sell I'm to there to get people. Business from the people in
right.
that room.
Right.
And I'm like, if I actually
don't feel that way.
Not only that, but I'll tell you, you know, something really crazy. If I was really like off the wall, because people won't do it, but I think it's the right way to do it. I would make a rule: you can't do business with people in the room.
Yeah.
How crazy would that be?
Let's help each other do business
yes.
with other people.
Everyone's got to refer each other. No one right. can do business with each other.
Right.
Now you can't sell each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Now people will be like, well, what am I mean, I can't sell you? Why wouldn't we work together? Because in that mindset, you would be like, I have to now work with you.
Right.
How can I introduce you to people? How can you introduce me to people?
Right.
And that's what networking is about. It's not about selling each other.
No, it's about who can you meet. Who can I help you meet and who can you help me meet? That's
correct.
What networking's about.
Correct.
Bruno taught me that very early on.
Good.
Yeah, because I think that a lot of people, if they – I was in a group once where it wasn't that you couldn't do business together, but it was – there's no solicitation. So
correct.
It's the buyer who says, listen, I need a car. Can you help me
correct.
Out? It was never any pressure.
Correct.
Just go out and bring business. And it's a good – I think that's the right mindset.
It's
yeah.
a good mindset. But I tell people this. I say, listen, if you go into any networking organization, there's got to be three things you got to think about – before you join a networking group. The first thing is, are the people in this room relevant for me? Can I help them and can they help me?
Right.
Not about directly working with each other for sales.
No, but maybe they're all plumbers and electricians. I'm a lawyer. How the hell do I help these guys?
Well, if you were a lawyer who worked with construction law, it
right.
might be
then
great
it'd
for
be
you,
different. Right.
Right. So again, it comes out, is there relevancy to people in this room?
Right, okay? Correct.
So I tell people, that's the first thing you have to qualify. Is the people in the room relevant? If they're not
right.
relevant, what you're wasting your time.
Wasting your time,
okay?
Sure.
That's the first thing. I learned that from the tip group, right?
Okay.
The second thing is who's running this group?
The facilitator, you mean?
The person who runs this organization.
Okay.
What kind of person are they? Are they someone who gets involved with you? Are they someone who says, good luck, hopefully you do well? What kind of person are they? Do they have a mentality of very structured, and I'm a structured person, I like that structure? Or are they more loosey-goosey and more social, and I like the fact that I can do what I want?
Right.
What is their...
Like either one's okay, but it's got to fit with what you want.
Exactly.
Right. That's good.
So that's important to know who's running it and what is the feeling like in
right.
this organization? Is it like me?
Right.
Do I feel good in this organization?
Right.
And then the final thing...
So
okay,
it's like, is the facilitator supportive of me?
Well,
or not, is this hands off? Thanks for your check.
100%.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are like that.
Right, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, and then the last.
Those groups don't last very long, by the way.
Some do and some
no,
don't.
No, because people peter out. Or maybe they just keep having a revolving door.
Yeah, it's exactly right. So anyways, yeah. But the point of the whole thing is that the last thing, which is really important, is am I going to commit
yeah.
to being there and being there for the people in that room? Because if I'm not willing to do that,
right,
you're wasting your time again.
Correct.
Okay?
So you put all the time in, nobody shows up, and you're like, what am I here for?
Exactly.
You got to be able
so
to.
So if
yeah.
all those three things come together, then you have a good chance of doing well in that group. It's still not guaranteed, but you have a good chance.
No, it's a good formula, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are the three things I say you have to look at first. Now, the thing that I do when I interview the members, I don't want a lot of turnover. Because if you have a lot of turnover,
you can't
build
relationships.
It's not value for anybody.
Right, right.
Because the people, I thought that we had a great
what
IT.
Happened to Dan?
Right, we had a great IT firm yeah. or a great furniture company, whatever it is, right?
I just referred him last week. Now he's not here?
Exactly.
Yeah, it creates problems.
So you want people who are going to be there for the long term.
Right.
So I built in various things to make that happen by grandfathering people so their price will never go up as long as they stick with it.
Right.
Giving them the expectation, do not expect any business your first year. Give a lot of business your first year. Support the people in the room. Get them to know you, like you, and trust you. And if they do, they will give you business over time.
Of course.
But if you don't do anything, why do they? They don't owe you anything.
Right.
So don't think because you paid your check, you're going to get business.
Did you ever read the book, The Go-Giver?
No.
That's a really good book about being on the long end of the giving stick. I think it's a series of books, but it's a short book, like a Ken Blanchard type of a book.
Sure.
It's a very good book about being a giver,
yes.
always giving to help other people, not expecting a return,
exactly.
and you get it back anyway.
Exactly. So it's about setting expectations.
Right.
So I tell people, if you have the expectation.
Well, that's why they quit, because they have wrong expectations.
Exactly. So and that's why it's important.
Then it hurts everybody.
Yes, but when you're qualifying someone to join the group, and they think, well, I'll join and see how it goes. The first question a lot of people ask, can I come month to month? And I say, no.
No, because then you're not making any kind of commitment.
Well, not only that, but it shows me the kind of person they are.
Right.
They're looking to get out as soon as they can.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
they can't commit.
I say,
mind.
You know what? I don't think, and I tell them right in front, I probably think this group is not going to be a good fit for you.
Yeah.
Because you need to give this a minimum of 2 years where you're giving as much as you can your first year to see the results in your second year.
Yeah.
And if you're not willing to give it 2 years, you shouldn't even come into the group.
Right.
So I actually would really love to say, you got to commit to 2 years,
right.
but that would be too much. People would never do this.
Of course.
So yeah. I say, it's 12 months and
right.
you can renew if you want.
Right.
My feeling though is that if you gave a lot of if you gave a lot of opportunities and referrals and you actually supported the people in the room for your first year, you should see something in terms of, even if it's not sales, you should see some sort of activity.
Most situations you will.
Some activity by the end of your first year.
You give back, right.
Now, you surely should close business in your second year if you're doing the right things.
Right.
Okay? So I always tell people, your return on investment, because people care about the return on investment.
Of course.
Is that you got to give it enough time to make it work for you, or don't even start.
Right.
And it's kind of like advertising. If anyone's ever advertised before, if you put one ad out there, you're not going to get business.
Yeah, no way.
You got to keep advertising to get people to remember you, right. Know you.
Yeah, they got to. What they got to see you 5 or 6 times so they even think you're real.
Exactly.
Oh, maybe this guy's really in business.
Right. Yeah. So I say you got to give it the time to make it work.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
So
yeah.
That's what I would tell people.
If you like our podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at beinlaw33@gmail.com. That's beinlaw33@gmail.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur has been written, directed, and produced by Mitchell Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about Mitchell and his practice, you can find him on social media or visit his website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.